Douglas North MHK John Wonenberg is approaching the end of his fourth year as a national politician. He's chair of the Manx Utilities Authority, which, unlike its private sector UK counterparts, is pretty good at supplying us with water and, with the exception of Peel and Laxey, has a generally good record of disposing the sewage we produce without polluting the environment. John joins me in the studio to talk about his role at the MUA, as well as reflecting on the state of Manx politics.
For these purposes, you're both member for Douglas North, but also the chair of the MUA. So we'll start off with that, because I was enticed to come and interview you by a big beaming smile on a couple of press releases I've seen recently. Which, of course, is your natural disposition. But effectively, the MUA is spending on the capital budget on various things. The one particular one that we're going to talk about first is the, what's it called? The new treated water reservoir and pump station in Jerby.
That's right. That's what we are going to talk about. And yes, we do have to spend money. If we're going to keep our infrastructure fit for purpose, then that takes investment.
And the infrastructure, of course, has had significant spend over many years. But as I suppose we can see from the water and sewerage companies in the UK, if you don't keep spending, you can end up with significant problems.
And that's exactly right. And we only have to look at the news from the UK to see that there are many problems with water and sewerage and contaminating beauty spots. Here on the Isle of Man, we are very fortunate. There are some things we need to sort out, and our regional sewerage treatment programs have been put into place. They are working very well. There's still two sites to be done. But overall, we're in a far better position than what they are in the UK.
And Jerby, why specifically does Jerby need this fancy new reservoir and pump station?
Well, it needs a new pump station. I wouldn't necessarily call it fancy, but it needs a pump station simply for the future expansion of Jersey and also for the firefighting capabilities of the fire service. These are fundamental things which need to be put in place so that we can grow the population up on the Jerby site, which needs to be done, frankly.
And it has been a long time coming, this. Certainly, I briefly spent some time as a stand-in clerk for Jerby Parish Commissioners and became aware of this issue. It's been a long time coming for Jerby, and certainly there have been concerns to the extent that temporary water storage tanks have been installed to help with issues particularly relating to possible fires.
That's right. It's a £2.9 million project, which will probably be the best part of a million litres kept there of treated water. In the short term, well, once it's done, it'll take about 12 months to do, but people around Jerby will have better water pressure. They have far more consistent water pressure, and overall it is absolutely the right thing to do. But again, you know, we accept that there's going to be a little disruption to people in and around Jerby, but for the future resilience, it is definitely the right way to go.
And you mentioned there some disturbance. What kind of interference with people's lives are they likely to see?
Well, not that much, given that the site is actually on an industrial estate. However, you don't just put in a 12-month project on a subterranean reservoir without there being any disturbance. So there will be some.
So I guess things like noise and machines travelling to and from the site rather than interference with water pressures and things like that.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean, Phil. Yeah, that's right. Sorry if that wasn't clear. And I think it's only right at this stage that we thank Jerby commissioners for their support in this regard as well.
So The other thing that I've noticed, I had a trip down to Andrus not that long ago, and there's a set of temporary traffic lights, and a very large blue pipe seemed to be going in. There's works ongoing down in the north to improve the water, I guess, all around the north of the island.
Well, that work never stops, Phil. I mean, what I can tell you is that every year the MUA puts in 12.5 kilometres of new piping along the waterway. So that's just a continuous programme of investment.
Are we... Because another recent UK announcement was these new reservoirs. There are going to be several new reservoirs built, to particularly in England, to deal with what appears to be frequent droughts and the needs for things like hosepipe bans and the like. First of all, how close have we come to something like that? I know the MUA issued a press release not that long ago saying use water wisely, but of course we've had a very long dry spring. So how are water stocks at the moment?
They are pretty good, to be honest with you. We had a board meeting last week and this was discussed, and we're in a good position, but we are very mindful that our reservoirs fill up very easily, but they also drain very easily. We're ahead of this time last year, and as long as we monitor it, I don't think there'll be too many problems. But if and when the call comes to for a hosepipe ban, then that's what we'll put in place, absolutely. But at the moment, we're strongly positioned.
And if we are expecting to see longer-term spells of dry weather like we've had in the spring, has there been any thought at this stage of whether we would need an additional reservoir built?
That's not something that's come across my desk, so to speak, at the moment. I suppose that it would be a thing which we could consider for the future if the climate continues the way it's going. But let's be honest, I think the one thing that we do have on the Isle of Man, lots of green fields and plenty of water.
And long may it remain. In relation then to, you kind of alluded to this, and I know we're not going to specifically talk about this because there's other developments likely to happen, but the two sites in relation to sewerage that haven't as yet been dealt with are Peel and the sort of Laxey Garth area.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And both those, I mean, the Peel site, we've just got cracking on with that very recently. And again, thanks to Peel commissioners for that. And the Garth one, we're just tidying up the last bits of admin on that. And we hope to make progress on that fairly soon.
And that then presumably will complete the whole of the island. Effectively, we won't any longer be allowing raw sewage to be discharged into the sea.
Well, that's the ambition, Phil, and that's in line with, you know, what we want for our delicate marine life along our coast, which is treasured by a lot of people. In this day and age, we should not be putting sewage into the sea in any shape or form. So once these two sites are completed, and I would hope that Peel would be completed in 27 sometime, and then Garth shortly thereafter, then I think we would have a fully functioning sewage treatment system right across the Isle of Man. And again, that's thanks to the continued investment that the MUA puts in.
Have we got past the sewage is treated, the sewage is treated, and then it's available in a kind of pellet form, and that ends up being burned, is that right? Or have we found a way to actually use that? I know at one point it was being used as a kind of a fertilizer around trees, but I don't know. Are you aware of where we're at with that?
You know, I'm not aware of that, but I know the IRBCs, they separate the solids as such, and the solids get taken back to Merrivale, and the balance gets refiltered and then sent back into the outlets. But that is treated, and that is absolutely fine to be done with that. But as I say, the big parts, the solids, they get taken back to Merrivale for, I would imagine, burning.
And then relation to the sewerage, the other thing that we know is that the IRIS scheme, as it was referred to, is probably one of the largest electricity users on the island. Certainly, it was when I was in government. Is that still the case? Because there's an awful lot of sewerage pumped around the island, isn't there?
Well, that's exactly right. It doesn't go uphill by itself. So it does take a lot of power. And, you know, would it change in the future? I would imagine so. But here and now, that is the only way we can do it. It does take a lot of power. But fortunately, we're the ones with the power.
So the other thing that's been announced reasonably recently was the Crosby and Glenvine. What is it? Something to do with sewerage, anyway? Is it
a treatment? Yes, the regional sewerage treatment system for Moran and Crosby area, which, as you probably know, next to the new co-op, there's a little collection of houses that's been put in there, and not only for that reason, but for the whole area, it needed an upgrade on the sewerage treatment system. So that has been done. Well, it's been done. It's been, over the last 18 months, it's been done, and only recently has it been completed. That was a project which came in on time, under budget. The budget, I think, was £8 million, and it came in under that. So we were very proud of that little area there. It's doing exactly what it should be doing. And the old treatment system has been taken out as well. So it's been landscaped now. It's just right next to the Heritage Trail. If you ever look at it, it's quite appealing. And it's doing exactly what it should be doing. And again, this goes down to the investment which the MUA has been putting in, and the speciality team that's gone in there. We worked along with a third-party partnership with Paul Carey and Sons. They did a fantastic job. And Phil, I'd like to take you down if you'd like to go down and have lunch sometime.
And of course, this is one of the... I don't know, is it a sad thing about being an MHK? It probably isn't. As members of the public, we largely are unaware of where a lot of this money is being spent on, you know, the big capital schemes. I remember a fairly significant piece of work done in Arbury in relation to a water storage reservoir, and I was really impressed. Yeah. You know, you go into these places and they're just amazing to see. Big pieces of construction with huge implications for the island, and actually you do kind of get excited by visiting these things.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. I mean, I was lucky enough about a month ago, I went to go and have a look at the Selby Reservoir. We went underground the reservoir. Now, that's really interesting. And then also we did the hydroelectric plant down in Thorty Will, I think it's called. And that another fascinating piece of machinery that's in there. And the job it does, nobody would know, but the fact that it's there speaks a lot to the investment and the training that's been done. And we are in a very good place with all that kind of infrastructure for us.
And of course, that hydroelectric plant, that's been there pretty much since the reservoir was built. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. I think it was 1981, if not earlier. I mean, I looked at the plaque on the wall. It was Sir Charles Carruthers who opened it. So that'll give you an idea of the dates. And I think we're putting a little bit more investment in there just to give it more resilience, because, as you know, it's been there for some time. But it is a fantastic little resource.
Should we be doing more in relation to hydroelectric? I mean, again, lots of people suggest, they say, oh, well, look at the Laxey Wheel. We should have that connected to a generator and think of all the electricity we would generate. But I guess it's perhaps not as great an opportunity as some people might think.
I think you're probably right there. I think it produces something like 2%. When it's running, it would produce something like 2%. And whilst it produces electricity, the water itself is obviously wasted, because that just goes back into the system, back out. So it is a delicate balance you've got to keep. Whether it's a resource you want, the water, or is it electricity? So in that regard, it's a fine line to balance these things. But the infrastructure, and particularly the Selby Reservoir, it is almost like James Bond-esque when you go in underneath there. It's got huge bits of apparatus, and it's all run by two or three guys who know exactly what they're doing off a laptop. It's very impressive.
And, of course, that was the Isle of Man government really thinking very much into the future about what the island's needs were going to be for many, many decades to come. Do you think we do enough of that visionary thinking? I guess the MUA's plan in relation to the wind turbines is part of that kind of visionary thinking, although obviously I'll declare an interest on that particular one. But are we doing enough generally as a government to look at the future of the island and what the infrastructure needs are going to be decades to come?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak with some authority about the MUA, so I'm very comfortable that we are doing that. Yes, and not only are we thinking ahead, but we are maintaining what we have already, and that is just as important as to think ahead. In terms of the government thinking ahead, well, obviously I'm not in cabinet, council of ministers, but I support them when they are thinking like that. And think what you want about the island plan. What we are trying to do is make this population that we have more resilient for the future. I mean, we're going to need more tax receipts. We are going to need things like that to provide for our pensions, to provide for our social care, to provide for our schools. So we obviously have to think for the future all the time. But I'll curtail my remarks just to the MUA, simply because that's my involvement within government.
And is it 2 years, I think, you've been chair of the MUA now? And I suppose that will have been quite a change from chair of the OFT.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah, it's definitely different. And to be honest, I came to the MUA expecting it to be difficult. It hasn't been easy, but on that hand, I'm working with a bunch of people that I would never have come into contact with otherwise. And to say that I've been impressed by these guys and girls is an understatement. I mean, they are very good and very dedicated as to what they do, whether it's, smart meters being rolled out, whether it's water and sewerage, whether it's generation of electricity, gas turbines, or whatever it is. And even the future thinking for the wind turbines. This collection of people are well placed to put our island in a strong place for the future. And going for the board, we've got a board of some lay members, and they are hugely critical to our plans in the future. They question us all the time, and rightly so, and make us better at what we do.
And how does that relationship work? Because obviously you are a board. As chair of the board, you get to smile for pictures in the newspapers and things like this. But as chair, you don't have sort of ultimate authority. No. You have to bring the board along with you. How does the board interact then with the MUA, the day-to-day operation of the MUA?
So I don't bring the board along with me. They will make their own mind up on whatever the case is. And being a board member, I have one vote out of several. So I can't lead anybody, but I can certainly give them my opinion, and I do that quite often, as they do theirs. What's the second part of the question, Phil?
How do you interact with the team here at the MUA?
So obviously the exec, led by Phil King, who's the chief exec, they are the day-to-day operational team. And I wouldn't dream, nor anyone of the board, tell them how to do their job. They are best placed and they do a good job. But their decisions will be examined by us. The policy going forward will be set by us, collectively with the executive. So it does work very well, because some of the board members have huge experience in different disciplines, and they can hold, whether it's finance, whether it's engineering, whatever it is, they hold our guys to account. And our guys love that challenge in putting it forward and making the best case.
And some of those board members as well have significant international experience of the energy business, haven't they?
Without a doubt. And when they say they have international experience, whether they come from Brazil, or whether they are from Spain, or even in London, they bring a set of expertise that we wouldn't have but for them providing it. And that's to our strength.
Is there anything in relation to the MUA that has surprised you since you've become chair?
I think I could say that coming from the OFT, it is we champion the customers there, and I was very pleased to have done that. It is a little bit more reactionary than possibly the MUA. Is that going back to our earlier conversation? There's a lot of forward planning, and I'm sure there is at the OFT as well. But the infrastructure for the MUA, whether it's cables, water pipes, whatever it is, it's got to be so carefully considered, and it's critical to everyone's life on the Isle of Man. Whether you flush your toilet, have a cup of tea, whatever the case is, it's absolutely critical. Whereas the OFT is a little different, but also hugely important for what they do in terms of customers, and particularly vulnerable customers. And when I was there, I really enjoyed it. But am I pleased I'm at the MUA? Oh, there's no question. I mean, I've learned so much myself in the last 18 months to 2 years. I'm really pleased to be here, and I think the team do a great job. Do they get things wrong sometimes? Possibly. Do they fix them? Absolutely.
And, of course, when you get to our age, the more cups of tea you drink is the more often you flush the toilet, I guess.
Oh, Phil, you know me well.
What I suppose you're approaching 4 years into being an MHK. I think it is fair to say that no one was more surprised to find that you were an MHK than you after the general election. You did, I guess you went into it expecting not to become an MHK, which is probably the best way if you are challenging for a seat. Assume that you're not going to get in, and then if you do, it's all the better. Am I misinterpreting?
No, I think you're exactly right. But now that seems so long ago now. But no, I stood because I wanted to have my say on how my business was treated during COVID, and I don't want to go into that again. I've said all I'm going to say on that, but that's why I stood. And the fact that it was an election was, it was a great summer. I was happy to knock on everyone's doors. So it was surprising when I was elected. It was a very nice surprise, don't get me wrong. But a surprise nonetheless, yes.
What floats your boat politically? What motivates you in relation to politics?
Well, I'm only here to serve the people of North Douglas. And obviously now that I'm in MHK, wider so as well. But my constituents put me here, and my first loyalty will always be to them. So if I can help them, that is exactly what I will do.
And in relation to any sort of political philosophy, I mean, how do you decide? Because obviously you can't go and ask your constituents about every vote that you take. How do you make your mind up whether to support government or whether to give government a bloody nose, depending on what on the various issues that come forward? How do you go about doing that?
You're right. I don't have a straw poll on Facebook or anything like that. I think the people elected me because they want me to make the decisions on their behalf, and sometimes that's difficult to do. How do I do it? If I have a gut feeling that something should be done, and if it's in what I think is the interests of the people, then that's what I'll do. And I'm quite happy to criticise, and I have criticised government on many things. But it is equally as important to support where I think they are right. And sometimes the popular vote isn't the right one. And I mentioned Steve Jobs in the chamber the other day. If you want to be popular, you need to sell ice cream. Don't be a politician. On the very rare occasions, the popular vote is the right thing as well. But I can just do my best. And the people will hold me to account in the September next election. And I, you know, all I can do is hope that I've done a good job.
So that does sound like you might be thinking about standing again?
You're putting words in my mouth there, Phil. But who knows? I may and I may not.
No, I thought I was using your... I was interpreting your words, but okay. When you got elected, obviously things wouldn't have been quite what you expected. What were the things that most, struck you as being different to what the public perception of being an MHK is?
Well, just back up a little bit further. I mean, I've been self-employed 25 years. If I want something to happen, I'll make it happen today, as far as my business goes. When it comes to an MHK, you've all of a sudden got 23 new best friends, and you want to get something done, you've got to speak to 23 new best friends. That can be glacial at times. It takes time. And even then, it takes longer when you get the agreement than action plans, meetings need to be done. And it's very frustrating for me, and I'm sure for others as well, as to why things take so long. So that would be my first observation.
Thinking about that kind of role as a politician and how you work with colleagues, is the fact that we don't really have party political structures a problem, do you think, in as much as, you know, the public vote for you because they think you're a nice chap? They don't vote for you because you have a policy on this and a policy on that and a policy on the other. Therefore, when you are all 24 newly elected MHKs, and particularly when there's quite a churn in terms of the new members of MHKs, it takes some time then to work out what the political direction collectively is going to be.
Well, I mean, I think we can kick this around for a long time. I've seen members of parties vote against each other on more than a few occasions, so I'm not convinced that is the right way forward. I mean, for instance, if David Ashford and myself called ourselves the North Douglas Party, I think we'd be quite successful at voting on similar issues. But I think, as far as myself, if I would describe myself to you, Phil, I think I would describe myself as a entrepreneur, a businessman, but with the conscience of a socialist. And I think if I can maintain those two aspects, that is a good thing. But when it comes to paying, for instance, the health service, as much as I want everybody to have good health service, someone's got to pay for it. When I say someone, that's the taxpayer. And there's only so much money in the pot. And every pound has to be thought of as to being the last pound. And it's a very difficult line to walk at times. And does it give me sleepless nights? Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, I look around the room and I've thought more than one occasion, it's us. We are the ones who are deciding this thing. And that is a scary feeling sometimes. And whilst it's a huge privilege to be an MHK, it is a burden that is very heavy at times.
And I think perhaps, well, maybe you can reflect on this as well. Certainly in my experience, the public expect you to be on call 24 hours a day. They perhaps don't acknowledge just how difficult being an MHK is, and the complexity of the role, and the strain that has in terms of the MHK.
Well, I think, Phil, and you will know, until you do the job, you don't really know. I mean, a lot of people take pops at you, and sometimes it's deserved, and sometimes it's not. But that is the way the game is played, and we just have to suck it up.
Social media is a bigger, much bigger part of the role of a politician now. Obviously, you engage with that from time to time. I guess that just adds to the pressure and the stress, in that you have to be there. Well, you don't have to be, but you, if you're not on social media saying what you're up to and what's going on, people are questioning, well, where's so and so? Why is he or she not telling us more about the particular issues of the day?
Yeah, social media is it a two-pronged sword, isn't it? It is good because you get to connect directly with people, and it's not so great because people can sometimes be quite condemning of you without knowing all the facts. And the one thing about social media is that I'll put something out to say something's happening. And very often people want to draw me in for a debate on social media, and that will not happen as far as I'm concerned. It is a broadcasting tool, and I'm quite happy to have a chat with somebody offline. But it can be inflammatory, and I do try and stay away from that.
There is a, I mean, I hadn't appreciated this until I stopped being an MHK, but I think there's a certain number of, particularly the anonymous social media actors, who effectively view this as a version of Coronation Street. It's a bit of entertainment on an evening after you've had your tea. You go and see, can you bait an MHK? Do you think that's the case?
Yes, I think I would agree with that. The art is not to be drawn into that, but I know that some colleagues are, and that's for them to answer for. I don't think there can be any winners by arguing with people on social media. If they've got something they want to argue about, I'm quite happy to see them face to face. I'll go around, or they'll see me in a hustings, or whatever the case is. But to put it on social media for all the world, and you know, most people are well-intended, and most people want the best for the Isle of Man. But there are those who would seek to undermine you and make you look bad and make the government look bad. And I think that's my role as an MHK. I can make the government look bad when I think they are being bad. But if people who argued to that way had all the facts, then maybe they wouldn't put the arguments they put forward.
And is that possibly a misunderstanding, perhaps, about how democracy works? I think sometimes there is a view that as an MHK, you are there as my representative, my appointee, and you must take note of everything that I think. Whereas in reality, democracy is about electing the best person to make the decision on your behalf, and then that person needs to basically get on with trying to make the best possible decisions. It's quite difficult sometimes to try and, effectively, you're riding two horses of one, public opinion, which by necessity doesn't know all the facts, and then the other being actually the right thing to do is the opposite of what the public think.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, if you go back to democracy when it was first came about, I think it was the ancient Greeks who brought it around. And the ancient Greeks also developed the word called idiot. And idiot meant those people who don't get involved. So everybody should be involved with that, whether you stand for election or not. I mean, everybody's got a stake. Everybody's got entitled to an opinion. But that doesn't mean that all those opinions are valid. It might be to the person who's expressing it, certainly, but it may not be completely qualified. I mean, I would far rather work on a basis where people who know what they're talking about will come to a sensible conclusion. But just to have a push at somebody for no other reason because they are somebody, that is counterproductive.
And some of your colleagues, I think, are definitely struggling with that kind of pressure. Which is quite sad to see, because there are some MHKs who I know are really good, capable members of the House of Keys, some working in government, some not, who are loath to get involved too publicly in things because of the inevitable abuse that will follow.
That is exactly right. But, you know, when you become a politician, you pretty much put yourself up for that. In my view, you know, I've attended some public meetings which haven't been particularly easy to go through, but it's important that I'm there and I hear what people have got to say first and foremost, but I also express my own view. Now, in my own constituency, you know, I'm a constituent as well. I also have a view. But sometimes that conflicts with other people's views. So I've got to be very mindful of the best way forward. It is hard.
The 3 years ago, obviously, the members had pretty much formed the Our Ireland plan. I think you collectively, all the MHKs got together and council ministers did their best to reflect the views of the majority on most of the issues. So that plan then was issued. What did you expect 3 years ago? And are you surprised by the pace of delivery, disappointed by the pace of delivery?
So, yeah, we all had a brainstorming, I think, in the early days. And we all put ideas which we thought were good. But, of course, what you're doing is putting 24 manifestos into the melting pot. And whilst some things will be important to some people, some are not to other people. So what did I expect? I mean, I think when I came in, I expected us to have an economic recovery after COVID. And I expected us to sort the housing out. And I expected us to, I think, have a more resilient, well, not more resilient, but a better planned health service, should I say. Whereas that seems to have gone out of control with the expenditure. The housing seems to be glacial. And the economic recovery, although if I listened to Alex Anson on your program the other night, it would seem that it's certainly underway. But of course, you've only got to walk down Strand Street to know how hard it is for many of our little businesses. And I have a number of friends in hospitality, and I know how difficult it is for them. And I wish I could do something, say something, which would make it better. But it's going to take a huge amount of time. And I think that the tent pegs, so to speak, have been put in. And it is going to take that time. That's it. I think we're in a better place than some other places. But it's hard times at the moment. And that's why I did support the minimum wage right the way through this parliament. And I say that with the caveat that I think it was the right thing to do to pause it this time around, because small business, they are the absolute pulse of the economy. If they don't make it, we haven't got anything. And I'm a small businessman myself. I know how important it is. So we've got to get that right. We've got to get the environment for the economic recovery to take place. And I think that is on the way. I'm not so sure it's quite as advanced as what Dr. Anderson says, but it is on the way. And that's a good thing. And long may it continue.
And there is a certain amount of catch-22, isn't there, about growing the economy? You need to grow the economy at the moment because obviously we need more income to pay for all the various services that are required. But of course, needing to grow the economy means that there isn't at the moment lots and lots of money sloshing around waiting to be spent on various schemes to help grow the economy. Well, I don't know. How do you overcome that? And do you think government's doing enough to in terms of prioritising spend towards economic growth and the areas that are most likely to grow the economy?
Look, I think we could always do more. But, you know, when I came in, anyone who looked at my manifesto will tell you that I'm not a huge green agendaist. Although I do accept, for instance, without getting into it, the wind turbines. But I accept that because from a business perspective, I think that is the right thing to do. Going back a little bit, I thought the Kroger development was the right thing to do because that had huge potential for the Isle of Man. And both of those things could shape our economic recovery for years to come in the future. And I was sorry to see what happened to Kroger. So we need a new sector, I think. Whether it was banking or e-gaming in the past or tourism years and years ago, we need something else to make our own. I'm not sure that I could tell you what it is, but that is the kind of thing which is going to reshape the future for us. Otherwise, we just continue the way we are.
Is tourism capable, do you think, of making a comeback, bearing in mind that more and more people are discouraged from flying halfway around the world for the holidays? They're thinking about carbon footprints and the like. I guess, you know, where we used to be was most people from the cities in the UK, and indeed from Dublin, used to come on their holidays to the Isle of Man. And we've got a fairly low carbon way of getting here on the boats. Do you think that a sustainable tourist sector is a way forward for the future of the island?
It'll never be what it was. I mean, you only got to look back into the First World War when they had 500,000 visitors a year to know how booming it was back then. So it will never be that again. But that doesn't mean we can't forge a place for us in this new world. What do I think? I think if we position it correctly, whether it's heritage weekends or anything like that, I think we've got a future. But it's got to be done in such a way that people would want to come here, will want to spend the money. And I don't think it's a secret that I think getting here is half the battle. So if that was a little more easy for people to get here, then they can come and enjoy the Isle of Man. And I think, you know, I've been around to many different places as well. And what we have here is really, I don't say it's undervalued, but it's underestimated by a lot of people. When they come here, they are blown away, I think. And if we can position ourselves in a way where we constantly exceed the promise, then we've got the makings of an industry, yes, certainly. But we cannot be complacent. We've got to push that all the time. And I think Deborah Heather and the team over there do a really good job. I think for a while before that, we had lost our way. We had relied on what we were. But I think going forward, again, we are putting, you know, the flesh on the bones at the moment. I think we're doing well.
Where would you go, or indeed would you go anywhere in government if you had a really good business idea? Who are the people that you would most trust with that idea to actually help grow it and make it happen?
That is a very good question. I'd probably ask you, Phil, do you think this is a good idea? And if I see that glint in your eye, then I know I've got the makings of something. Where would I go? Depends what the idea was. I would find someone to tack it on to, but that, it's easy to say I'd go to the Treasury Minister or I'd go to the Enterprise Minister, but I don't know. I would want an industry professional to tell me that's got the juice to run.
Because there has been some criticism, I'm not sure it's a universal criticism, but some criticism that you send a good idea into government and it disappears into a whole load of bureaucracy, never to see the light of day again. Do you think we're smart enough when it comes to these things? And I guess you have to be prepared to take some level of risk when it comes to new business.
Well, in my own business, without risk, there's no reward. So yes, you do have to take a risk, and sometimes that can be expensive. But the dividends can be enormous as well.
And of course, in relation to government, officers are loath to take risk because they know that if something goes wrong, chances are they're going to get blamed and persecuted by some, at least, either in social media or indeed even in Tynwald.
Yeah. I know I'm a chairman of the statutory board, I'm not a minister, but I will not accept that from anyone at any time. You will take risks if and when we think it is appropriate. And bear in mind that it can go wrong. But, you know, now and again, you've got to shake the tree to get the fruit down. You've got to go forward.
Is it the role of the chair of the board, the minister, the political member, to take on that responsibility, to effectively to say to officers, actually, I want you to crack on and I want you to get on with this. And if things go wrong, then, you know, I will shoulder the responsibility.
No, without question. I mean, for a second, if you just take the political segment out, then work would go on as it does. That's why we have elections every 5 years, so fresh thinking can come forward, so new policy can be put in place. So yes, is the answer to your question. And if things go wrong, things go wrong. And, you know, we need accountability and we need transparency. And it's not illegal, it's not a crime to try something and if it doesn't work, you know. Whereas before, if it does work, the yield can be fantastic as well. So we constantly have to innovate and get better. And that does involve taking risks. And that does mean sometimes it can go wrong. But you know, we have to take an informed risk, I think.
Do you think Tynwald is aware enough about the need to occasionally take some risk? Or do you think perhaps Tynwald is super cautious, possibly reflecting the view of the Manx public, and as a result of that caution from Tynwald, officers in government then say, well, actually, I'm not going to risk doing this without having done a full investigation and several reports, and by which time the freshness of the idea has long since disappeared, and our competitor countries have probably cashed in.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, without putting too fine a point on it, if people want to de-risk a project, that usually means that the end date is extended. And I understand when you're talking millions of pounds, that is the right thing to do. But again, I reiterate, you know, we cannot just be what we are all the time. And sometimes we've got to move quickly, faster than others, to get to be the first entrant in a new market, for instance. I mean, we look at medicinal cannabis. I'm not so sure we have been as quick off the mark as we should have been. And it would appear to me, and I'm no expert in this, but it would appear to me that other jurisdictions have stolen that from, well, not that we ever had it, but we could have had it, maybe. So, you know, success has many fathers, Phil.
How do we get, because we're almost at the end of the program now, but how do we get to the position where we started with this conversation, where you were saying, you know, you are a businessman, and if you want to do something, you crack on and you decide and you get on with it and you make it happen.
Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't work that way in politics. How can we at least introduce some level of that to kind of speed up decision making?
That's the multi-million dollar question, and I wish Steve Jobs gave me an answer for that. I don't know, but there are enough intelligent people in government and politicians and civil servants to know that this is what we should be doing. And whether we form a small sort of, not away from government, but a small project team to brainstorm and think about things in a different way, maybe that would be a way forward. I don't know, but one thing's for sure, we need to do it. And that's all you're getting from me.
Well, I did try earlier. You did say, and of course, when I stand at the election, that's the time for people to make their mind up on how successful or otherwise I've been. Does that mean that you are standing?
Well, Phil, if the people have me, it may be the case. I honestly don't know. You know, if you asked me this question today, John, would you stand, yes or no? I probably would, yes. But there's a year to go, and it's the back end of the administration. A lot can happen in a year. A lot can happen in a week. But so we'll see what happens, Phil. I'm not a quitter, not in any way, shape, or form. I like to get things done, but I only get done with the support of other people in the first instance, with the people of North Douglas, in the second instance, with people that I'm working with. That's when you get things done. Sometimes that can be painful, but I'm not a quitter.
That was Douglas North MHK John Wannenberg. So what do you think? John may be soft-spoken, but he appears to be growing in confidence as an MHK. Would you like to see swifter decision-making and action in government and Tynwald, as John suggests? If so, how much risk would you be prepared to accept? Are we too quick to judge officers and politicians when they get things wrong? Or perhaps you think we're too soft on them? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayos and Geishtachrom. Thanks for listening.